My name is John Lenz, and I'm an alcoholic. Everybody. Thank you, Tom. Love you, too. It's really great to be back in the Lilburn area, my old stomping grounds. Five Forks Sobriety was my home group for about 20 years. My sobriety date is June 1st, 1983. My home group is Johns Creek Group. I've got a new sponsor. I'll tell you why in just a minute. And I do sponsor guys. It's a tremendous blessing for me that I have that that kind of experience in my life. The folks that are involved in my life today, I never would have thought possible that I could have those kinds of relationships. The kind of a relationship that Tom is talking about, where we've known each other for years. I can tell you this. Before I quit drinking, you would never know me. You would never really know me. I would never allow it. Partly because many times my values and my actions were mismatched. They were always in violation. And when you live like that, you don't want anybody to know that. And so to get to know people was not something that I was willing to do. As a matter of fact, by the time I got sober, I had pushed just about everybody away from me that were in my life and moved 3,000 miles away. And so as a result, when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't know how to have a relationship. And I was very fortunate to have a series of sponsors in early sobriety that taught me what it meant to have a relationship in this program and outside this program. John Holmes was my sponsor for 30 years. A lot of you know John, and he passed away the day after the International Convention. And I was very involved in the convention here in Atlanta last year. And Mary Emma knew that, his wife. And she kept saying, "Don't come down, don't come down." And the day after that he passed away, I was going down. And I was calling her to finalize the arrangements, and that's when she called. Actually, she called me right before I was calling her to let me know that John had passed. It was a very sudden situation, and he was an amazing guy. He taught me so many things, and the kind of relationship that I had with him has radiated out into the other relationships in my life. And you know, that's how Alcoholics Anonymous is, I think. I was very fortunate to have Bill Roop as my sponsor for a short period after I moved back from California. And then John became my sponsor. Both of them died with over 56 years of sobriety. Both of them were four steps removed from Dr. Bob and Bill W. in sponsorship lineage. It's about the program being passed down from person to person, sharing their experience, strength, and hope. One alcoholic talking to another, just like a number of folks have said today. So I'm very grateful to be here. The last time I was at the Unity Weekend, John was speaking. So this is very special for me. I want to thank you, Tom, again, and the committee for asking me to do this. And I want to thank everybody that's had a chance to talk during this weekend. Sean, on last night, you did an amazing job. And everybody that has gotten up here has really shared from the heart. And I got to tell you, Chris, you were inspiring. You know, people in AA go through all kinds of things in their lives. Some go through it fighting and scratching all the way. There are those, though, that show us how to do it with dignity and grace. And I can say that that's something that you're teaching us how to do. If we ever find ourselves in that situation, we can go through anything as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous with dignity and grace. It doesn't mean that we're happy about it. It doesn't mean that we approve of it. But it does mean we can go through it and be okay as a result of that. And everybody that I know that does that also gives back. They're of service. I had a sponsee that went through a very similar situation, and we brought meetings into his home. And every week we'd say, "Do you feel like us bringing this in? You know, do you want us to bring this meeting in?" He said, "I want you to come in." and make sure you bring some newcomers. And this, the feeling of God in that room was incredible. There are people here today, or not here tonight, but there are people today that got their start in sobriety sitting in that man's living room listening to the experience, strength, and hope of he and his friends as we went through that journey together. It's just an amazing opportunity that we have that many people in this world don't have. And I feel really blessed to be someone that can experience those things. And I couldn't have done that if it hadn't been for Alcoholics Anonymous. So I'm very, very grateful. You know, one of the things that I believe very strongly in, that is that if I hadn't found this program, I wouldn't be alive today. And you're going to hear a little bit about that tonight. I also believe that I was born an alcoholic. I think I crossed the line the very first drink because I never drank any other way than alcoholically. I'm 57 years old, so that means I got sober when I was 24. So I was fairly young. And a lot of what I did to accelerate that process is, and I'm not going to dwell on this in this because this is AA, but I did a lot of drugs when I drank. And I think that accelerated my process. As far as I'm concerned, it's all the same disease for me. It has different manifestations for some people, but for me, it's all the same thing. But I always drank. It's just the way it was. I was born in North Carolina, in Charlotte. When I was 5 weeks old, I was adopted by my parents. And I have a tendency to think that there was a really good chance that my parents, at least one of them probably, were alcoholic. I'm guessing I was probably conceived in the back seat of a car and alcohol was involved. I would guess that. Just thinking that that's probably what happened. I'm very grateful, though, very grateful that the parents that adopted me did. They loved me so much. And I knew that they wanted me. Now, as a budding active alcoholic, I was practicing my manipulation early on. So I would use that fact against them. Well, I'm not your son. You can't tell me to do that. You know, I hurt my parents that way. I really did. You know, it talks about in the big book, and some of the speakers, I think Shauna talked about it last night, about, you know, how we're selfish and self-centered, driven by 1,000 forms of fear. You know, we step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. I did that with everybody in my life. I did it wherever I could in order to get what I wanted. Because I wanted what I wanted when I wanted it. And that's just the way it was. And so I can see the pattern. And this is one of the great blessings of doing an inventory more than once. I can see the patterns in my life of my disease manifesting itself even before I started drinking. I was in first grade. And we ran a race out in the parking lot. And I came in second. And everybody clustered around the first place winner. And I'm over here on the corner by myself. And I felt left out. Hurt my feelings. Well, I was close. Well, I didn't want to feel that way anymore. As I went through my life, I became known as someone that would quit things. A family friend said to me once, when I told her that I think I'd stop playing the guitar, she said, "Well, I'm not surprised. You quit everything." Well, the reality is that if I quit, I can't fail. If it looks like it's going to be hard, or I'm going to have to put effort in, well, then if I quit, I just decided not to do that. And that's how my life went. You know, I quit a lot of stuff because I didn't want to fail. Fear of failure was an important thing for me. It drove my life. And a lot of fears drove my life. The fear of people making fun of me. The fear of being less than, the fear of not succeeding. So I started doing things to overcome that weren't really healthy. So I started lying. I learned to lie really early on. And someone, I don't remember who it was last night, said, you know, I hope you're ready. Are you ready for your, I think it was Jane. Jane said, you ready for your talk? I don't know if it was you, I think it might have been. So, you know, I kind of shrugged. And she said, well, you know, it was your life. And I said, well, yeah, but, you know, truth is variable as far as I'm concerned as an alcoholic. Reality is variable because I was a blackout drinker. So I wouldn't remember a lot of things that happened, you know, and so I made up reasons why those happened, or I made up the scenarios so that I could have a story to tell when someone asked me about it. And I also learned that when I lied, I had to live the lie. By living the lie, I was far more convincing. So I just became that actor that it talks about in the book. And I convinced myself that this was true. It was 6 months after I got sober that I was sitting in a coffee shop in San Luis Obispo talking to another fellow alcoholic. We were telling something, you know, telling each other about our background and history. And I had to stop and say, hey, you know, I just lied to you. Because I had told him that I had left a job when in real, actual fact, I had been fired from that job for being inconsistent and coming to work. And there were some other things too, which were part of that. But I had convinced myself that I'd left that job of my own volition so that I can live with myself. And drinking allowed me to do more of that. It allowed me to push all that negative stuff down into a big hole. In the bottom of that hole, there's this big spring. And if I didn't keep drinking, if I didn't keep doing other things, that spring would push that stuff back up. So I had to keep pushing it down. And when I got sober, all that stuff started coming up. It made early sobriety really hard. Because I was dealing with all those emotions and all those thoughts and all that garbage that I'd been cramming down into that hole for so long. But what I discovered was is that if I walked through it, I could come out on the other side and I wouldn't have to go through that particular garbage again. Might have some more garbage. And there's good stuff down there too, because I pushed good stuff down too. Because what I was looking for was oblivion. I was looking not to feel. I drank for the effect, like the book said. So as I'm going through grammar school, I also saw some other patterns. One was in third grade. I was sent over to Birmingham to the family of a gentleman that my dad worked with. And he had a couple of kids my age. And I was homesick. And I couldn't sleep. And we were out playing during the day, and then I wasn't sleeping at night. And one day, we were going along this cliff, and there was a bunch of rocks down below, probably 30 or 40 feet below. And I looked down, and I said, you know, if I fell head first, I wouldn't have to feel this way anymore. That was the first time I thought about checking out. You know, the big book, one of its working titles before it was published was The Way Out. I was looking for a way out almost from the very beginning because I never felt part of, I never felt comfortable in my own skin. And so I started looking for ways to get out. Now, you know, on the surface, I looked okay. I was hanging out with the neighborhood kids. I was playing every sport in a season. You know, these days, you play one sport and that's all you get to do. I played every sport there was. You know, when the season changed, I was doing something else. And I was okay with it. In school, yeah, I didn't do so good because I didn't want to do it. So I found myself writing I will not on the board a lot. Because I got bored and I started getting in trouble. But I made it okay. I mean, I could pay attention in class and get by. I didn't have to do a lot of studying. I wasn't making A's, but I could get by. And then along comes eighth grade. And I go into eighth grade. Back then, there were no middle schools, so eighth grade was high school. We were in with the big kids. And the plan was to play football. So I started off that year gung-ho. We were competing again on grades, the bunch of us. I was playing football, and then I came up lame. I had a problem with my heel. I couldn't run. And my buddies gave me eternal grief over that when I had to stop playing football. And so I decided that, okay, I'll show them. I decided to go back in the summer practice, and I'm going to do good here. My heel's healed up, and I'm going to play football again next year. Well, I was completely out of shape, and they were hazing me terribly. So about the fourth time, I got a helmet in the groin, and the coach was yelling at me to get up and, shake it off. I said, I don't need this. You guys can have this. And so I quit. And almost immediately, I was no longer part of their circle. Now, I never really felt part of their circle. If you ask them, I was part of their circle. I never really felt part of their circle, though. So when that happened and they started shutting me out of their conversations and what they were doing and all that sort of thing, now all of a sudden I'm completely separate and I'm alone. Well, there was a group of people in my home room that sounded like they were having an awful lot of fun. It turned out they were the people that were into alcohol and drugs. And I went over to a friend's house out in Stone Mountain. And we went up on Stone Mountain, and he had some pot. So I got stoned for the first time on Stone Mountain. Thought it was fitting. Went running across the mountain, happy and free, and this is great. So that was on a Friday. Monday morning, I stole a full peanut butter jar full of bourbon. Back then, you had glass peanut butter jars. And I took it to school. And I was popular that day because the guys I was hanging out with wanted some. And so I started drinking and doing stuff in the mornings before school. Back then you could smoke in school, so I had a cigarette permit. So I could kind of keep that smell off to a certain extent. And I got by with it. So this is in the fall. October time frame. I got a job that allowed me to have money to buy this stuff. I had a fake ID almost immediately. I could go in and buy it. By the time December rolled around, I was qualified as a member of this program. I was qualified probably from the very first day, but I was getting loaded daily. And I continued to go through school. I prided myself on being extreme. I did a lot of crazy stuff. And we just kind of went through school. I'm not going to get into a big drunkalogue, but I'm going to tell you about a couple of things that happened during my drinking career that kind of exemplifies what Norm out of California talks about, seconds and inches. And this is part of why I probably stayed sober after I got here. Because when I drank, you never knew what was going to happen. It could be a nice, calm evening. Everything could go great. Might remember it, might not. But it would maybe be a nice evening. And then there were other evenings or days where it was just crazy. It was beyond belief crazy. I never knew what was going to happen after I took that first drink. And I always took a second drink. I always continued to drink after I took that first drink. When I read that part in the big book, it made a lot of sense to me. And by the way, along this way, I figured that I was going to be drinking as long as I lived. It was just going to be a part of me because it was so important. I organized my life around it. When my sponsor had me do a written first step, and I looked at how I organized my life around drinking, the choices I made, to go places or not go places, the times I got in trouble, it was all about drinking. I saw those patterns clearly doing that first step. And so, one of the things that happened is that, I would go out with my buddies and we'd raise hell. We were hellraisers, just pure and simple. We damaged things. We, you know, got in people's faces. We didn't beat up anybody. We didn't do any of that. We weren't violent that way. But we tore up a lot of stuff. So we would go out and get a six-pack or an eight-pack of beer and hit mailboxes every time we drank one. You know, we'd finish it and hit a mailbox with it. So one day, we're doing this, and my buddy missed one. He got mad. So he sits outside the window. I'm driving. He says, "Get as close as you can." So my tires are scraping the curb. And I hear, "Got it." And then he's back in the car, and I look over, and he's kind of shiny. I didn't know what was going on. And the guys in the back seat, there were three of them, said he hit that telephone pole with his head. I said, no. "Yeah, it splattered us." And I look over, and it had literally scalped him. There was a telephone pole this far, like 2 feet from the mailbox, but we didn't see. So we took off for the emergency room, driving 100 miles an hour. We got him there, carried him in, walked through the doors. We were screaming for help. They came to help us, and we started brainwashing him. You know, you fell in the library when we were playing Frisbee. Because we didn't want to get in trouble, right? But he couldn't get it right. He just couldn't get it right. So the truth came out, and everybody got in trouble. But fortunately, had we gone another quarter of an inch closer, I probably wouldn't be standing here today. My life would have changed overnight because I was the one driving that car. That's seconds and inches, isn't it? A few years later, we're out shooting his grandfather's .357 Magnum pistol, which we weren't supposed to have. We got back, and his parents had come home, so he couldn't take it into his house, so I took it home with me. And I'm just completely blotto in my room, in my bedroom. I was 18, I think. And I started pointing the gun at stuff in my room, just fooling around. I cocked the hammer back, and the thing had a hair trigger. And the hammer came down on an empty chamber, because that's how we did it. I forgot that there was still another bullet in there. I cocked it again, aimed at my lamp, and shot my lamp. Which would have been okay, except on the other side of that lamp, on the wall on the other side of that lamp, was a closet. And on the other side of that closet was my little sister's bed. And that bullet went through the wall, tore up all the clothes in her closet, and into the door of her closet. It was partially open. Had it been all the way open, it would have gone right into her. That's seconds and inches, isn't it? And, I didn't think much about it. It freaked me out. I hid the gun. I couldn't find it for 2 days. I don't know where it was, but it was in my mattress. I did that a lot. You know, when I got in trouble, I freaked out and stuff happened. You know, I lost my car once for 3 days. But, you know, when these things are happening, it doesn't occur to me that I'm getting loaded and that's part of the problem. It's just bad luck. That's all it is. Right before I got sober, about 3 months before I got sober, I was a photographer in California. I'd moved out from Atlanta. They taught me how to take pictures, and I was traveling all over California for this company. And I would party all night, get in the car, and drive 300 miles sometimes to this place where we would take pictures. I can't imagine now today what they must have seen when I walked through the door and set up this photo studio to take pictures in churches for fundraisers and portrait directories. I'd take pictures of 200 or 300 families in a weekend. Can't imagine what they smelled on me at the end of one of those nights. Well, one time I was driving to Eureka, California. And I'd been going all night, and it was probably 2:30 or 3 in the morning, and I came to. And right on my bumper was a Volkswagen Beetle. And I can still remember seeing the people in that car, illuminated by my headlights, and the fear on the faces of the people in the back, because they saw me coming. And I jerked the wheel over, and I probably missed them by an inch, passed them, and continued on. If I'd hit them, I'd gone right through them. I was going 55, 60 miles an hour. They were probably doing 25 or 30. Seconds and inches, right? Those are the kinds of things that happen to me often. Not that bad often, but, you know, in relationships, stuff like that happened. It's just something that was part of the deal. It didn't convince me to stop drinking. Now, that shook me, I got to tell you. It didn't shake me enough to stop drinking, but it shook me. So I left high school, and I went to the University of Georgia. And this was during the Herschel Walker days. A lot of partying going on. And I had a girlfriend that became my fiance, and I continued to drink a lot. And every semester, actually it was a quarter system, at the beginning of every quarter, I would start out gangbusters. I'm a sprinter, not a marathon runner. I need to tell you that. I would start out great. 3 weeks into it, I'm making straight A's. I'm still partying, but, you know, I'm not going out and staying out late at night. And then someone would come by and say, "Hey, dollar pitcher at the other place, come on." And I'd go with them. And I'd be out to 3 or 4 in the morning. I wouldn't have done my homework the night before. I wouldn't have gotten up for my class. And I would say, "Oh, that's no big deal. I'm just going to miss class. I'll do it another, you know, I'll go the next day." What ended up happening is this pattern occurred to where this was happening pretty much every day. And I would find myself 3 weeks later not been to class. I can't imagine what those people were thinking when I walked through the door, like I was just there yesterday and hadn't been there for 3 weeks, sat down in class and said, "I'm ready to learn." I didn't learn a lot. In my career at the University of Georgia, I withdrew from 23 classes on a medical withdrawal. Because you see, I knew that if I continued that way, I would get an F and I would fail out. And my parents wouldn't continue to pay for me to go to school. They wouldn't pay for me to stay there. And I couldn't have that happen. So early on, I started going to the infirmary. I had headaches and stomach aches. I had the flu. I had insomnia. I had every kind of ailment you could imagine. And that did two things for me. It set up my alibi, and it also got me their medicine. So I was ending up doing both. And I had a file like this at the University of Georgia Infirmary. But one day, I just couldn't continue to do it. Couldn't continue to do it. Now, I should also tell you, I never graduated from the University of Georgia, but 12 years ago, I was an adjunct professor at the Goizueta Business School at Emory University. You can't get from there to there unless you got something going on, right? With Alcoholics Anonymous, I think, or God. So, I convinced my girlfriend, she was my fiance by this time, that it would probably be best if I left school, got a job, because she was going to graduate the following year, and I would get enough money for us to get married on. So that's what I did. I left school, got a job managing a Sonny's restaurant, assistant manager, trainee, in Norcross, and started my career in the restaurant business. And all the sort of limits came off. You know, I could still function in the restaurant business being loaded. It wasn't that hard for me. I kind of could get into autopilot and I'd just do the job. But there were times when I just couldn't make it to the job. So that started causing problems. And along the way, I also realized that, you know, my fiance and I weren't happy together because I was drunk all the time. She actually stopped drinking. She was one of those Al-Anons that said, I'm not going to drink. I'm going to be the example for him." Didn't work. Just, you know, allowed me to drink more because she, you know, the amount of money I had only so much alcohol limit, right? So when she quit drinking, I was happy because I got more. But that didn't solve the problem. And I knew in my heart of hearts that if we got married, it was going to be a disaster. that it would be a nightmare, that we would never be able to have a happy life because I couldn't stop drinking. She'd asked me to stop drinking once. I spent about three weeks controlling my drinking. I did all the things that it says in chapter 3. And at the end of my trying to quit drinking, you know, I would end up in the hallway playing with coat hangers, drinking rum at 3 o'clock in the morning. I don't know why I was doing that, but that's what happened more times than not. I was doing something stupid. So I just quit. I quit trying to stop. I just figured I'd try to moderate as much as possible. But it was really clear to me that we weren't going to be able to have a happy life. So the night before our invitations were going to be printed for the wedding, I called her up and I said, I think we need to have a trial separation. And at the end of that 30 days, I said, we need to make this permanent. There were some other issues around that. Long story, I'm not going to get into that. 5 days later, I completely regretted that decision. But I couldn't go back. And I thought to myself, I've lost the most important thing in my life ever. I've lost it. I'll never get it back. So I decided to kill myself. I took a whole bottle of Ecotrin because I understood that you could OD on aspirin and die. And I wanted Ecotrin because I didn't want to have a stomach ache from it. The alcoholic's logic, right? It didn't work. A few days later, I took a whole bottle of phenobarbital and drank a half gallon of scotch. Took myself out into the woods to do that. This was, 11 or 12 o'clock at night, 3 or 4 the next day. I wake up, sun's beating down on me, the birds are tweeting, and I'm going, is this heaven? But I was alive. And I came home, and something I need to let you know is that, my parents loved me a lot. My dad didn't know how to show it. He never hugged me, never told me he loved me. When I got home that day, they realized something was up. I went to bed at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And I woke up in the middle of the night, and there's my dad sitting next to my bed. Because he loved me so much, he didn't want to take the chance that I might do something to myself. I'll never forget that. Later on, after I got sober and came back from California, I started hugging my dad. He was all prickly when I did it. It was really clear he wasn't comfortable. By the time he passed away about 10 years after that, as I was leaving, the first thing he would do is say, come here for a hug. And he'd tell me he loved me. You can't have that kind of stuff happen in normal world, right? I haven't seen it anyway. Direct result of this program. So, the next night, I got a syringe. And I shot air into every vein I could find in my arms and my legs and my wrist and my ankles. And I lay down to die. And I awake to this knocking on the door because I was staying at my parents' house. My mom saying, aren't you going to work? Well, I hadn't set my alarm. I hadn't planned to be getting up. So I got up, and for the next couple of weeks, I kind of walked around thinking I'm going to keel over at any time. And at that point, I realized maybe there was a reason for me to be here. So I quit trying to kill myself. Along the way, I lost a job in the restaurant. I went out to California. My drinking did not stop. It didn't moderate. It continued to increase as much as I could. And I'm out there doing the thing in California. It was a crazy time. And Memorial Day weekend, I'm on my way to Gilroy, California from Fresno to do a photo shoot. And I realized I couldn't do it. I just couldn't do it. So I called them up and I said, I can't make it. My car is broken down. And they said, where are you? And I told them. I said, well, we'll come pick you up and bring you over and you can go ahead and do the job. Here's the problem. I was 100 miles away from where I told them I was. So they were going to come somewhere where I wasn't. So I immediately started planning the insanity defense. I was going to drive to Northern California, drop my car, take a bus to Southern California, disappear for a couple of weeks, and plead insanity. That's not what normal people do. I'm sorry. It just didn't. But it was my plan. Well, they couldn't find anybody to come pick me up, so I went home, and I called. Well, what happened was I started drinking the clock around. I was drinking, waking up, drinking, waking up, drinking, waking up. And during one of the times I woke up, I saw a commercial on TV for a treatment center in Merced, which is about 90 miles away, and I called them because I didn't want to do this anymore. I had a little bit of clarity there that I couldn't. It was when I said, I can't see drinking, I can't see not drinking, like the big book talks about. And so they said, why don't you go to a treatment center in the town you live in? And they gave me the number. And this was the night before Memorial Day, and the nurse said, You can't come in today. We're going to be closed for intake. Can you come in on Tuesday? And I said, yeah, I can do that. And I was really happy because that gave me two more nights to party before I went in. I didn't go in on Tuesday. I went in on Wednesday. And I walked through the door, and they sat me in a day room and right in front of these steps. And I'm looking up at those things, and I'm seeing God everywhere. And here's something else. It's a little dangerous if you work steps without a sponsor. I also saw the thing about the inventory. But the thing about God freaked me out. I just didn't want to do it. I had conveniently decided God wasn't important to me. It wasn't an aspect. It couldn't be anything impersonal to me. I would actually argue with you. I would enjoy getting drunk and arguing with you about the existence of God. And then I saw as we understood Him. The guy that argued for that phrase saved my life. Because I decided, why don't I just give this a shot? I also saw the thing about the inventory. So when they brought me into the intake room and they started asking me about myself, I told them every deepest, darkest secret that I had. Everything. All the things you would hold back in a fourth step, in a fifth step, where your sponsor beats it out of you, I told them. Because I was raw. I'd made the decision that I was going to do everything I could to try to make this thing work. So all that stuff's written down in Fresno. I'll never run for public office because someone will sure dig it up. But it was really good for me because it really showed my commitment to give this thing a shot. I went through 30 days of treatment. They sent me to a halfway house. I told them I'd do anything they asked me to do. I didn't fight with anything. I just did it. Because I figured I had nothing to lose. And that's something that's really important to my recovery. What have I got to lose by trying these things except for a little pride, ego, fear, and pain? And so I tried those things. Now, that doesn't mean I was perfect. I was in the halfway house. I got 13th step, which I enjoyed immensely. It definitely put me back. There's no question. Relationships in early sobriety are distracting, and they will hurt your sobriety early on. But I got kicked out of the halfway house for not paying my bills and not showing up. I found myself without a job because I quit my job because I didn't think I could stay sober. I put my sobriety first. Problem was, in 1983, we were in the middle of a recession. I couldn't find another job. So I got a job selling vacuum cleaners. Now here's this sensitive, newly sober alcoholic with all their nerve endings raw, going door to door, knocking on people's doors, asking them to buy $800 vacuum cleaners. How well do you think that went over? Not so good. So I didn't sell a lot. So the guy, and I have gone too long, but the guy that I worked for said, you're struggling. I'm going to do you a favor. I'm going to give you a job in our repair department. I'm going to pay you a salary so you can live until you get yourself straightened out, because he knew the story. I gave him the story. By the way, I told everybody my story because I felt it. Well, it gave him the reason why I didn't have a good resume anymore. I mean, that was a reason. And it will also a little bit, I was just looking for sympathy, right? It was bad motives. My sponsor always said, first thing I opened my mouth, he said, "What's your motive?" I hated that. So he said, "I'm going to put you back in the repair department and let you repair vacuum cleaners until you're ready to go back out in the field. We think you have promise." What did I hear? I didn't hear a guy doing me a favor. I didn't hear a guy telling me I had promise. What I heard was, "You're a failure. You'll never amount to anything. And you're going to repair vacuum cleaners for the rest of your natural born life." See, that's what my disease tells me. It tells me it's going to be like this for the rest of my life. If I'm feeling bad, if I've got fear going on, if things are not going well, it's going to be like this for the rest of my life. That's a long time. I couldn't conceive of doing that. So I had to think about it. So I drove to the top of a mountain, one of the most beautiful vistas in the Sierra Nevada, as you can imagine, looked out over this beautiful area, and contemplated two things. I could either repair vacuum cleaners for the rest of my life, or I could shoot myself. I knew where a gun was. So you would think that because I'm standing here tonight, that my decision was to repair vacuum cleaners. It wasn't. I decided to shoot myself. So I headed down the mountain. It's lucky I didn't kill me or anybody the way I drove. I decided that drinking wasn't an option. But you know, we're here sort of in a service setting, right? Service saved my life that night. I've been in a lot of service positions in my life in Alcoholics Anonymous. But this was the first one. Unofficially. I mean, they had me sitting next to a guy in detox the second day that I was there. And I said, "You know, I can't understand that. How can I help this guy?" "Well, you've been sober one day more than he has. You can help him." So I learned service early on. And I was put in charge of a group when I was 4 months sober. So I was responsible for setting up this meeting. And it occurred to me that someone out there might need a meeting. So instead of shooting myself right then, I decided to go set up the meeting and then come home and shoot myself. With full intent to do that. I got to the meeting, set it all up. It was a candlelight, 10 o'clock candlelight meeting at the halfway house I'd been kicked out of. And that weekend there was a conference in L.A. and all the people that usually went to that meeting went to that conference. 5 minutes before the meeting was supposed to start, one person showed up. And I asked her to lead the meeting. That's kind of how it was done out there. And no one showed up. So I figured, okay, let's shut this thing down. I'm going to go home and shoot myself. That was my full intent. She said, "Whenever two or more gathered," and she started the meeting. Out in California, in that area, they qualify for 5 or 10 minutes. They tell a short version of their story as they start the meeting. And by the time she'd gotten through that, a couple more people showed up. And that night I shared what was going on in my life, what was in my head, between my ears. Had I thought to call my sponsor? No. But service saved my life, because I found myself in that meeting because of service. That night my path narrowed. There hadn't been a single time since that day that suicide was a serious option. Because that night I discovered that suicide is a permanent solution to a temporary problem. That it will change. That it's not going to be like that for the rest of my life. And the reason why I talk about that when I get up here is because I know that there are people that think that way. That's a good idea. I've had friends in this program that have killed themselves. That perception that it's going to be like this for the rest of my life follows me everywhere. It's part of my fear. When I'm in a job, I'm afraid it's going to be like this for the rest of my life. When I'm in a relationship that's not working, I feel like it's going to be like this for the rest of my life. It's not. Especially if I'm sober. And and I'm working steps with a sponsor. Because those steps automatically force me to realize the craziness that I live in. That second step, right? Restore me to sanity. So, I continued to stay sober. I lost everything. I can remember sitting on a curb with the vanity license plate for my car that I'd given back to the bank, wondering, is it going to get any better? My roommate that same weekend started shooting dope and drinking, and I didn't have anywhere to go. But the reality was, is I was getting better. That whole time I was getting better. I was going to a lot of meetings. I was, you know, very involved in meetings. But I wasn't working steps at that point. So when I started working steps that I really started changing. I'd worked some steps in treatment and then said, okay, I know I need to do it again, but because that wasn't really a good thing. But I was busy. Well, I believe that if you don't work the steps all the way through, you're doomed to drink again. And I was, or kill yourself. And that's kind of where I was. So I started working steps with a sponsor. And my life started changing. And as time went on, I got a job in Atlanta. I moved back. I didn't know how to work sober. So I just drove around all over the Southeast, going from hotel to hotel and going to a lot of AA meetings. And they let me do that, fortunately. But eventually something clicked and started working for me. And all of a sudden now, I'm having people tap me on the shoulder at trade shows and saying, John, we'd like you to come work for us. John, we want you to set up a business for us. And so every 3 or 4 years, my income is doubling now. There were times when I thought I did it. I didn't do it. I showed up. I worked the steps. I got involved. I was of service. That prepared me to be of service to the companies that I worked for. 20 years sober. Everything was going wrong. I was having trouble with my kids, my wife, my job. I lost my faith one day. Now, I should say that the third day that I was sober, this whole God thing, they sent us to an outside meeting. It was on second step in the 12 and 12. In that book, it gave me permission to use a group as my higher power. That's exactly what I did. And it worked for me. And over time, my understanding of God changed, and it became more than just the group. The group is still a big part of my higher power, though. But I lost my faith. I couldn't see how all this stuff could be going on after this long time. You know, what says that when you have time that automatically you deserve something? It doesn't work that way. In any case, Ed Mutum had been talking down in Hilton Head. He was a year sober. The night he took his 1 year, he had dinner with his parents. His dad went to the bar. And as he's on his way to a meeting, he drives past the bar and there's all these flashing lights. Somebody had gone in and shot 8 people. One of them was his dad. He lost his faith that night. So I called him up. He was in South Carolina. He was from Iowa. He was in South Carolina that weekend. I went up and spent a weekend with him. And I came to terms with that. And I haven't had to go back through all that crap again. It's something that my faith matured again. See, as I stay sober, as I do the things that I'm told to do in this program, my faith matures if I'm willing to let it. In 2008, with the financial crisis, on into 2009, I had 5 companies. Now, I'd lost everything twice already. I had 5 companies. They were all very successful. We had most of our eggs in about 3 or 4 baskets. Those baskets went Chapter 7, pulling us millions of dollars. I didn't have as many millions as I lost that day. And since then, I've been struggling. I've been doing consulting. I've been trying to get my businesses back going. Nothing seemed to work. half a dozen times. It looked like something was going to magically happen. It didn't. It came up to the very end and then it fell apart. I used all my retirement. You know what I did? I went to a lot of meetings. I went to a meeting every day for a long time. I still go to a lot of meetings. Because when I'm sitting in a meeting, there's a couple of things that happen. One, my batteries get recharged. Because the world beats me down. I need my batteries recharged. I need to plug in. I need to know what's important. The other thing that it does is it allows me to be of service. When I'm of service, I'm not thinking about me. I'm not thinking about all the garbage that's going on in my life. I'm not thinking about the fear of what's going to happen. I'm focused on the task at hand. And along the way, my faith... And by the way, I can't tell you what I believe. It changes on a regular basis. My understanding changes based on where I am today. But what I do know is that when I put my faith in God, that things work out the way they're supposed to. And here's where my faith matured. I used to think that if I did God's will, everything would turn out okay. And my definition of okay was actually, I'll get what I want. It doesn't work that way. I got what I got. And I have to go back to the third week that I was sober when that nurse that I talked to on the phone originally sat me down and showed me page 449. Now in the fourth edition is page 417 on acceptance. Acceptance is the answer to all my problems today. It's also the key to my faith. Because without acceptance, I start asking the question, why? And every time I ask that question, the answer is unknowable. So I'm sure to be crazy. So what I've discovered is, if I just don't ask the question why, I can remain fairly sane. When I start asking the question why, I know I'm in trouble. I also know I'm in trouble if I lose my sense of humor. I lose my sense of humor after about 3 days without a meeting. It just happens. So I go to a fair number of meetings. But the reality is that the key to my faith is simple, but it's complicated. It's simple because the things that I've been told to do here in Alcoholics Anonymous have worked every time I've tried them. And as long as I continue to do those things, my faith remains strong. I do those things even when I don't feel like it. I do those things when I don't think they're going to work. I mean, I faked believing in God for a long time. I started praying. I didn't believe in who I was praying to. But I did it anyway. Because ultimately, as it was said today, all it takes is a willingness to believe. If I had that willingness. And early on, I was just trying to be willing to be willing. So as I've gone through my life, I've had an opportunity that I've lost friends, family to death, and tragedy. I've lost jobs, I've lost relationships. I've been able to stay sober through this simply because I've done a few simple things. I've showed up. I've gotten involved. Today, my life isn't great, but 4 weeks ago I got an amazing job. It's the first time I've worked for somebody else in 15 years. They're paying me a bucket load of money. I'm not qualified for what I'm doing. But I've been given an opportunity. And I don't know where it's going to lead, but I'm going to keep working on it. My kids have never seen me drink, because I've been sober almost 33 years. I've got a 27-year-old and a 23-year-old. My son tried alcohol for 6 weeks. At the end of that 6 weeks, he was drinking a fifth of vodka a day. He said, I can't do this anymore. He was bleeding and everything. So he stopped drinking. He hadn't had a drink since. I never would have done that. My daughter, on the other hand, has had migraines for the last 10 years. Severe migraines. She couldn't even go to school the last 3 years of high school. She taught herself geometry. She's on a cocktail of medicines trying to prevent and knock down and It's crazy. Well, I know, and I knew then, that she started self-medicating. I personally believe she's at the point where she's in trouble. Things are happening in her life. Car wrecks. All kinds of things are going on. Can't help her. Most powerless I've ever felt is when I can't help my kids. When they're sick and I can't help them. But here's what I know. That as long as the people in this room continue doing what they're doing with service, we'll keep that unity in this program. And there'll be a place for them to come when they can. They've grown up knowing about the program. Shauna was talking about that last night. They were like that. Although they didn't have the drinking in their lives. They had craziness. I mean, alcoholics sober doesn't mean they're sane, you know. But all I can do is love her. She knows I'm there for her. And maybe one day she'll find that solution that I found. Probably run a little long. But I never know what I'm going to say. You know, the committee in my head, when I get up at one of these things, they start playing pinball. And as the balls bounce off the different bumpers, it, you know, it's racking up points, but it's also taking me in different directions. So I appreciate your bearing with me tonight. There's no question in my mind that this program is divinely inspired. There's no question in my mind that it wouldn't continue without service. And there's no question in my mind that as long as we all focus on the basics, that we can stay sober and this program can continue for those that are out there still suffering. Really grateful to be here tonight. Thank you.